بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. We have been reviewing quickly the history of philosophy in the West, and we said that after the decline in scholastic philosophy and after Renaissance, there was a second turn for skepticism. And we said that skepticism is very harmful, and it can damage not only religious issues but also scientific matters. Of course, having doubt by itself is not something bad, something shameful, but remaining in the state of doubt and finding no answer, this is not good. So doubt is a good transitory state, not something for ever, something that we can rest at. So if we look at the screen, we would see that, as we said in the previous session, with the denial of the value of knowledge, that means with a skepticism, with the idea that we can have no knowledge about the world, there can be no hope for the advancement of sciences and learning. Because a scientist, just if I want to put it very simple, a scientist every day goes to his, for example, lab, to his research room, to university. Why? Because he has a hope that he can know some of the laws of the nature. He can know something new. He can discover something. If there was no, there were no hope, if the way to discover the truth and the natural facts was completely closed, so why scientists should bother themselves to continue their investigations and their research? So there can be no hope for the advancement of sciences and learning. Secondly, there will remain no room for moral values, because moral values are based on the possibility of having some knowledge about what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad, what we should ought to do or ought not to do. So if there were no possibility for knowledge, so moral values also will collapse. And also religious dogmas will collapse. So as we have on the screen, religion also loses its intellectual basis. This is also very important. So with the idea of skepticism, you must say that either I don't believe in religion at all, or my religion is not based on knowledge, on discovering truth. So that means that our religion loses its intellectual basis. So many people truly realized the necessity of combating against this new form of skepticism. So generally there were two forms of resistance. One was the attempt made by the church to combat against the skepticism, and the other, the attempt which was made by some philosophers to resist against skepticism. So let's see what was the reaction made by the church and what was the reaction made by some philosophers. The church thought at that period that the best way to get rid of this skepticism is to cut off the dependence of the religious dogmas upon reason, upon intellect, upon intellectual arguments. So they thought to serve religion, we should get a sort of independence for religion. But independence from what? Independence from reason. Independence from arguments, from proofs. So they said, to be a faithful person, to be a believer, you are not required to have sound arguments to back up your faith. Even some people said that indeed it's a matter of a strength in your faith if you have no argument for your faith and you still hold onto your faith. And some people said, even if you have arguments against your faith, it's still good. It shows that you are really believing in God. Because although there are arguments against you, you still believe in God. So this is something that you very frequently found among some Christian theologians and also some philosophers of religion known as fideists. We are not going to talk about this issue. It needs to be addressed separately. But anyway, this was one way. So if you look at the screen, we can just sum up it in this way. In reaction to a skepticism in the 17th century, the church tended to cut off the dependence of Christianity on reason and science, and fortify religious doctrines through the heart and faith. So you don't need the brain or the mind or intellectual assessment. What is more important is heart, and the faith lies in the heart. So this is one idea. Of course, this idea was not totally new. You can find traces of this idea in medieval ages. For example, regarding the issue of Trinity, many scholastic theologians and philosophers also have had the same idea, that you shouldn't listen to reason here. And it's well known that Saint Augustine used to say, believe and then you come to know. So you shouldn't first try to find some ways to know something and then believe in that. You must first believe, and after you believe, you gradually will know that that was true. Okay, this was the first reaction. The second reaction, which was made by some philosophers, was to seek a firm basis for knowledge and value. So these people thought a strong basis for sciences, for different sorts of human knowledge, especially for experimental sciences and also for values. These are very important issues. So, if we want to know the major attempts made at this period, we must refer to a very important French philosopher, and that is René Descartes in the 17th century. He is the one who is called as the father of modern philosophy. So the idea of Descartes was to seek to look for some grounds for human knowledge, which is very firm, very strong, and unshakable. And then build upon that. This idea is known as foundationalism. Foundationalism, because there are different currents among philosophers. But one of the most popular ones from the time of Greek philosophers is foundationalism. It means that you first build some foundations for your knowledge. Your foundations may be one proposition, maybe several propositions, and then you build upon those foundations other levels of knowledge. And you must be able to show at each stage that how these propositions depend on the lower propositions and those on the lower. And I mean by lower, more underlying ones. The more you go towards the bottom, the more fundamental, the more basic, the more underlying propositions that you have. Okay, so Descartes was looking for some foundation. He was thinking a lot. He was reflecting a lot. And finally he came to this conclusion, that the best point to start with, to begin with, is to begin with our very doubts. If I doubt about everything, I cannot doubt about my doubt. Because you may doubt about the world around you, you may doubt about the existence of the room, the books, the trees, the flowers, the people around you. Even you may doubt about yourself, but you may not doubt about doubt. Because if you want to doubt about doubt, still it means that you have doubt. So doubt is a very clear and self-evident fact about which no one can have any doubt. So, the most basic thing, the most basic thing that Descartes thinks to be appropriate to use as foundation for human knowledge is this, that I doubt, therefore I am. This is usually known among philosophers as cogito, the principle of cogito, because in French the famous sentence which Descartes was using was cogito ego sum. Cogito means I doubt or I think. Ego means therefore, sum means I am. So he was suggesting that because I have doubt, therefore I must be existent. So first, he thought that I cannot have any doubt about my doubt. And secondly, because I have doubt, so I must be there. Because you cannot imagine a doubt without having someone who has doubt. Okay? So, if I have doubt, so I must be there. Then, he started to build upon these two things in a mathematical way. Because Descartes was thinking that the best way to get rid of doubts is to make philosophy and theology resemble and look like mathematics. In mathematics, you have no doubts, because everything is built upon the foundations, upon the grounds, which are self-evident, which are clear. So he tried to use the same model in philosophy. So, mentioning first principle, second principle, third principle, and up to the end. So this was the idea of Descartes. And he caused much more interest in the philosophy and in revitalization of rationalism. Indeed, he is also one of the founders and fathers of rationalism in the 17th century. And this model was adopted by some other people like Leibniz, the German philosopher, like Spinoza. And these people had the same idea, of course, in different ways, but they all were thinking that we can discover the truth by our reason, and they wanted to save our rational and intellectual ideas. So if you look at the screen, please look at the screen. Okay. So you see that the most important effort of this period, I mean after Renaissance in the 17th century, for resistance against skepticism and for the revitalization of philosophy was that of René Descartes, a French philosopher who is called the father of modern philosophy. His famous proposition was cogito, I doubt, therefore I am. Or some people put it in this way, I think, therefore I am. Because if you have doubt, so you must be there, because without being there you cannot have any doubt and you cannot think. Descartes tried to formulate a specific laws of thought similar to mathematical laws. And this is what we call it foundationalism. So foundationalism is a very important idea which existed long before Descartes, but Descartes also presented a new form of foundationalism. But let's see whether Descartes was totally successful, entirely successful, or not. Of course, as I said, he was successful to some extent because he revived the interest in philosophy and rationalism, and he could convince some people that we can understand the reality by our reason. And this was very important. And he had the idea of innate knowledge, the knowledge that we know without any need to experiences. And this is just a matter of rediscovering them. But you shouldn't think, you shouldn't imagine that you can change the whole atmosphere of the world, the whole intellectual atmosphere of the world, just by one, two, three people at this period. In Europe, in the 17th century, in the time that some people like Descartes and Leibniz and Spinoza were trying to re-strengthen rationalism, another group of people emerged, mostly in England, who tried to say that our rational knowledge is very limited and the most important way to know the realities of the world is through our sensual knowledge, experimental knowledge, and these people were very influential and they changed the whole atmosphere of Europe in the 17th and 18th century. To mention some of the names of these people, these British empiricists, we can first of all mention the name of some people who were in medieval ages, like William of Ockham. But right after Renaissance, some of the most important figures were Francis Bacon and Thomas Hobbes and then John Locke and Berkeley and finally David Hume. These people were all British, they were all English. And perhaps because of the Industrial Revolution in England, these people were very much oriented in the same line. I'm not saying that they were influenced by the Industrial Revolution or not. I'm saying that perhaps the whole atmosphere in England was very much based on experimental sciences and technology, and these people were influenced by the same atmosphere and also increased to the strengths of the interest in the experimental knowledge and industrial developments. Anyway, these people were totally against the ideas of rationalist philosophers such as Descartes, Leibniz, and Spinoza. These people had the idea that we cannot have any certainty about metaphysical issues. They believed in mathematics. They believed in also scientific and experimental knowledge, but they didn't believe in many mathematical issues. And they thought that we can have no knowledge about the mathematical, about the metaphysical issues prior to experiences. This is a complicated issue. I'm not going to use that much technical terms here, but just for some of you who may have some background, the whole issue was whether it's possible to have a priori synthetic proposition or not. These people believed in a priori analytic knowledge which exists in mathematics and logic. But for metaphysics, you need a priori, means something prior to experience, which is also not analytic, which is synthetic. It means that the predict gives you something more than what is included in the subject of the proposition. Anyway, just for some of you who may have some background. So these people were not that much in favor of philosophy. They had their own philosophy, but their philosophy was indeed not that much metaphysical, not that much a priori that we expect. So their philosophy was empiricism. Of course, they were not all the same. For example, John Locke, who was before Hume, he was empiricist, but he still had some ideas which looked like the previous philosophers. For example, he had the idea that although we cannot prove the existence of substance by experiments, but we still need to suppose that there is something as substance. Why? Because if you have just accidents, if you have just a'raz, which you can sense, which you can experience, you cannot imagine that these accidents are there without something on which they can depend, on which they can rely. So he was suggesting that although I am not able to prove the existence of substance through my experimental knowledge, but I suppose the existence of substance. So as a supposition which is needed, as a requirement, he believed in the existence of substance. But when we come to Hume, David Hume, we see that he denied the existence of substance. Even he didn't want to have it as a supposition, as a postulate. No, he said we deny the existence of something for which we have no experimental knowledge. So Hume was the one who went very, very far, and he tried to be totally committed to all implications of empiricism. One of the ideas of David Hume was to deny causality. I know that causality is very important and very key principle in philosophy and also in science. So Hume said, what we can witness in the nature is that we have two things, A and B, and that when A comes, B comes. For example, when there is a fire, there is a heat, there is warmth. So we see that warmth or heat is preceded by fire. We cannot witness any relation between these two. We cannot witness causality. We cannot sense causality. We don't have any sense that can feel causality. The most we can understand, the most we can witness is just the occurrence of two things together. So he denied the idea of causality and just said that these are two ideas, what we say or call cause and effect. These are just two ideas connected to each other in our minds, to the extent that whenever we imagine the first, the second comes to our mind, or vice versa. But there is no causality. So, as you see, he was very radical, he was very fundamental in his empiricism. And he also denied many religious facts. After these empiricist philosophers, we find that a very famous German philosopher came into the scene, and that was no one other than Immanuel Kant, the famous German philosopher, who can truly be considered as one of the people who shaped, who formed, who influenced whole Western philosophy after themselves. So Kant says that I was very much negligent of the facts mentioned by empiricists, to the extent that he says that I was sleeping. And it was Hume who awakened me. The famous sentence which is quoted from Immanuel Kant is this, that it is Hume who awakened me from my dogmatic slumber. So this shows that he was saying that I was very negligent. I was like people who are in the state of sleeping, and it was Hume who awakened me from my dogmatic slumber. Hume proved for me. When I read and studied ideas of Hume, it was known to me. I discovered, I realized that it's not easy to come to certainty. It's not easy to have your dogmas, the ideas that you believe in them and you are certain about them. So Kant was very much affected by the ideas of Hume. Of course, he was not empiricist. Kant had a special idea, and his philosophy is known as critical philosophy. And his idea was to revive rationalism. But many people believe that Kant could not get rid of the ideas of empiricists, especially Hume. So, to be able to create a space for our reason and for having a priori synthetic knowledge about the world, Kant said that there are categories of our understanding, and these categories are not taken from outside, so we can be certain about them. These are categories inside our understanding, categories by which our understanding works. So, for example, causality. causality, as Hume said, cannot be taken from outside. But he said it is something which is built in the structure of our understanding. So in the first sight, you become very pleased that there is a philosopher who defends causality and says that it's not come from outside, it's certain, and you can accept it for sure. But when you look at it again and you reflect upon it, you see that it's very dangerous, because it means again that there is no causality outside. This is my mind that imposes causality upon something which exists outside. And he had the idea that our knowledge is a co-work of the reality outside and our mind. And this was the new idea about objective knowledge. So objective knowledge here didn't mean a knowledge which can correspond to the reality outside. It means something that is a co-work, a co-product of my mind and the reality outside. And we should distinguish between nomen and phenomenon. So phenomenon is the way that things look to us, but they are not the same way outside. So outside you have something, then your mind adds something to it, and then that looks in a special way for you. That is phenomenon. Inshallah, in future, when we talk about Islamic epistemology, we will talk about this idea more. So Kant had the idea that we can have metaphysics, we can have theology, we can have moral knowledge, but not in the way that medieval philosophers or Greek philosophers or rationalist philosophers were suggesting. His idea was that we must use our knowledge of our mind, of our understanding, to distinguish between two different categories. There is a category of objects that we can know by our theoretical reason, and there is another category which we can discover by our practical reason or practical intellect, whatever you call it. For example, he believed in the existence of God. He believed in the immortality of spirit, of human soul. He believed in free will. But he said, none of these can be proved by theoretical reason. These are the things that we understand by our practical reason. So Kant did not deny the existence of God, did not deny morality. He tried to find a secure foundation for them. But he said that's not the reason with which we are used to, the reason which is familiar to us, to philosophers before him, rationalists, Aristotle, and other people. This is just practical reason. Many people believe that we can come to a knowledge about God and morality through both ways. But he said no, only through practical reason. So many people after Kant, they accepted his idea that we cannot come to know God and theology and so on by theoretical reason. They accepted this. But they didn't accept the idea of Kant that we can know God, we can know theology, we can know morality by practical reason. So they totally denied these issues. So they said, okay Kant, we are thankful to you that you showed us, you proved for us that we cannot know God by theoretical reason. But sorry, we cannot accept this, that we can prove the existence of God by practical reason. So after Kant, because of the philosophical issues that he raised, which were very profound, many people, many Western philosophers, for a long period, have had the idea that there is no way to use our reason in religious issues. Either you must be an atheist, or if you are a theist, someone who believes in God, you must look for some other basis, through emotions, through religious experiences, and so on. Of course, there have always been philosophers in the West who have been defending theology and the belief in God in a philosophical way. But many, many people were influenced by the ideas of Hume and then by the ideas of Kant, and they accepted the idea that we cannot prove the existence of God by our theoretical reason, and they didn't accept that we can prove it by our practical reason. Okay, this was a summary of what happened after Renaissance in the 17th and 18th century. So by this, we have finished the second lesson of the book, and inshallah, in the next session, we will continue our discussion about the history of philosophy in the West in the 19th and 20th centuries. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.